To me, the most charming places of Japan are the rural areas. It's rich in nature, and there's a lot of local people that appreciate the tourists that do come around because they're rarely visited.
Oh, do they?
In my
Some of
personal
them
experience.
do. Some of them do. Some of them are extremely stubborn in their fear of foreigners, including local municipalities and some of the locals. And yeah, there are some cities and townships that have done a very good job at that. But there are also a lot of them that seem a lot more content with dying out rather than accept the scary foreigner.
Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, this is an interview that I've given to a young guy from Toronto, Canada. He used to live in Japan when he was younger, or even younger, I should say. He's pretty young as is, and he's considering moving back here. He's also considering starting up a real estate business here in the country. And so he wanted to pick my brain about a whole bunch of stuff. What are the hurdles for foreign buyers and property owners, and more specifically for rentals and property management services? What should you consider when starting a business here as a foreigner? What are some of the misconceptions regarding real estate in Japan, and why do people buy here in the first place? What does Japan's declining and aging population mean for its property market? What are the challenges in managing hospitality properties in Japan's rural areas? And what are the challenges in holding property out there in the boonies in the first place that people, especially remote property owners, tend to underestimate? We also talk about many of the assumptions that Japanese sellers and foreign buyers make about each other, and other assumptions that foreign buyers make about the market overall that might be wrong, rent increases, tenant-oriented legislation here, and what this all means for landlords. We break down the various buyer profiles that we serve, the different kinds of homes that these buyers prefer to purchase. And we also talk about a bit our own personal preference as buyers ourselves. So the issues that come with these older Japanese homes, structural inspections and how common or uncommon they are here, earthquakes, and in particular, the concern about another potential huge disaster like the 2011 tsunami. What does remote management of holiday homes look like for non-resident property owners? What complications do foreign buyers underestimate when they're purchasing here? And finally, we riff a bit about whether the locals in these rural areas appreciate tourists and visiting foreigners, and how Japan's current government might be affecting these sentiments. So really nice bird's eye view on the market here, but also a bit of a deep dive into a bunch of topics. Oh, and just a heads up, because he's based in Canada, which means we could only hold the conversation in the evening my time when I happened to be out at a friend's bar and restaurant, I was dressed pretty casually, so don't freak out if you're watching this on our YouTube channel and you're used to seeing me a bit more prim and proper in my office clothes. This was a bit more of me being myself visually. And if you're curious about our YouTube channel, by the way, feel free to check it out and subscribe. It's youtube.com/Japan Real Estate. Easy enough to find. Enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you again on the other side.
All right, Ziv. Very nice to meet you. Thanks so much for taking the time out of your day today. So, like I said earlier, I'm hoping to touch two points today, just regarding real estate in Japan as well as property management. So, I watched a few of the presentation slides that you posted for the summit, which seemed to have gone great. I'm really happy about that. Hopefully, in the next time I'm in Japan, I'll be able to attend. But just to boil down what you talked about, it seemed like you really wanted to sort of explain what it's like for buyers and sellers for Japan in terms of, the different expectation, this different experience, as well as some negotiation styles for foreigners, et cetera. So,
So more buyers and agents. The sellers would normally not be in direct contact with the buyers.
And so it seems important to have this sort of bridge between the foreigner and the local Japanese agent in terms of setting up expectation for the buyers and communicating clearly and in a way that both sides can understand each other better, right? So what do you think is some sort of, how to say, like the experience that's required for someone to be that bridge between the agent and the buyer?
Well, I mean, the first thing would be, I guess, the language and culture experience, right? I'm not sure. Is that what you're thinking? Do you think to move here and run that?
Yeah, for sure. Like language and culture, and maybe, experience having that on-site experience in Japan, let's say for 10 years, 15 years doing real estate, et cetera, because it's not something that anyone can just go straight into, right?
Yeah, but I mean, property management is a bit of a more specific sector within the real estate industry. So if you're talking about property management, that's a little bit different. It doesn't, well, for one thing, it doesn't require a license or a licensed real estate company. Anyone could open a property management company. And to sign the leases with the tenants, you need to hire somebody who is authorized to sign contracts. But aside from that, it's a lot more of an open market. And also, I think one that, I mean, with you obviously being a foreigner, the foreigner angle is something that you'd want to lean into rather than have it working against you, right? So you want to work in a business environment where the fact that you're a foreigner catering to foreigners would actually be an advantage as opposed to a disadvantage. And it's a lot easier. It's not easy, but it's a lot easier for foreigners to buy property in Japan than it is for them to rent a place in Japan, right?
For sure.
So there's definitely a niche there to be served. But I think the main difficulty there is in convincing the landlords to rent to foreigners, right? That's usually where. So there are some agents that don't want to touch that at all, and there are some agents who try to specialize in that, but they still have to run through a bunch of landlords before they land on one that'll actually consider renting to foreigners. So if that's a niche that you want to get into, it's very much a needed niche, but it's not easy.
I can totally see how that can be. A lot of foreigners, I think, feel sometimes overwhelmed and intimidated by not only just the paperwork, but also the language barrier that, comes with buying a property, or especially managing your property after buying the property. That's one of the questions that I'm gonna have later. But yeah, I just wanted to touch on the real estate side. One of my first question is going to be that a lot of people see Japanese real estate economy as, sort of unusual or risky. What do you think they sort of fundamentally misunderstand about Japanese market?
I think when people talk about it as risky, they're leaning on paradigms that are referring to the Western trends, or true. I don't want to say trends because it's not always true in Western countries as well, but there's this assumption that real estate always gains in value. And then they come and say, okay, well, in Japan, that's not necessarily the case. They say that properties depreciate, which is only partly true. The structures depreciate, but the structures depreciate all over the world. The thing in Japan is that the land, after 25 years of deflation, the land has lost a lot of value, right? And that's changed about 15 years ago. And now major cities are all gaining in value. Some of the rural areas are gaining in value. But the balance there is a bit more tricky. But I would argue that that's the case in many Western countries as well. It comes in cycles.
For sure.
So people are assuming that if they buy a property and they can't bank on capital growth, then it's not a profitable endeavor. But the people who invest in Japan are not banking on capital. I mean, you buy in central Tokyo, central Osaka, Niseko, a bunch of places in Japan, Fukuoka, then properties will gain in value, most likely, if the economy does well overall. But people invest here mainly for cash flow. They invest here for the hassle-free nature of the tenants and the property management company. It's a very well documented, very legal-oriented, legal recourse-oriented market. Paper trail to the moon and back. There's no monkey business. The tenants are docile. The property management companies are usually quite professional. The realtors are very heavily licensed and monitored. So people come here, number one, for the ease of management and the ease of purchase. They don't need to, look over the shoulders, make sure nobody's swindling them. That's almost never a thing in Japan. They don't need to worry about what the tenant's doing with the property. There's no squatters or forced evictions or ghettos and crime labs and the kind of stuff that you deal with in tenants in other countries. And the fact that properties in a lot of parts of the country are very affordable because of those 25 years of inflation, that actually makes the market easier to enter, and it also gives you diversity, right? So, for example, when I moved to Japan, I sold one property in Australia and bought about eight of them here for the same price, right? So that allows you to spread your capital socioeconomically, geographically. If you lose one tenant, then you lost a portion of your income stream, not the entire thing. So there are other advantages and other reasons to invest here that are not as intuitive to people who are used to investing overseas.
I see. Okay.
Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo or online, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in Webdisk Solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company, Innovatius, is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it, with a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top-of-the-list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model, as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $497 per month. And if that's not enough, if you've mentioned you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate Podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off. On again later if you want, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovatius comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob on robert@innovatius.com. And his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to increase your website's appeal, and provide you with an easy-to-read, detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today.
Yeah, you said you wanted to spread across your sort of portfolio with the properties that you're buying in Japan. And so my question about that would be, how do you strategically decide where to buy properties? I understand that Japan really values that 10-minute walk between stations. But for someone who, let's say, is interested in rural areas, let's say Nagano, etc., what do you think is like the three big factors that you should consider when buying properties?
Well, I wouldn't go for rural areas unless you have a very specific strategy that would work in those rural areas, like Airbnb or some other tourist destination kind of property. The main thing that we look in when we look into where to invest is the population trends, right? Japan being Japan, rapidly aging population, and a lot of, sorry, I'll just move to another room so that I'm not
Worries. Yeah.
bothering the people here. Give me a
Yeah,
sec.
worries.
Can you hear me still?
Perfectly. Yeah.
So, Japan being Japan, the first thing to look at is population trends of a particular city, right? So there are plenty of cities that are gaining in population. In a handful of places, it might be organic growth, like people actually having more babies than people are dying. But in most other countries, most other cities, it's domestic migration growth. So all of the major metropolitan centers, as the smaller townships and villages, for lack of a better word, die out, the people, the younger generations, are migrating into the bigger metropolitan center. So almost all of the big cities in Japan are gaining in population. That's probably going to be the case for another, I don't know, at least 10, 20, 30 years. And hopefully by then they'll do something about the population. But regardless, if you're going to be invested, why did you mention Nagano rural areas specifically? Like, what's the idea there?
Yeah, so I was looking into, vacation homes, et cetera. I've done many road trips through Japan, and what I found to be the most attractive about Japan personally is this quiet side of Japan in the mountains, where you're sort of untouched by civilization, where you can get away from the busy city life. And I do think that there's a lot of potential in there, considering a lot of foreigners, or let's say tech workers, live and reside in Tokyo, and sometimes they want time away from the city, especially for people who come from rural areas, or just more nature oriented places. So yeah.
That's very true, but so there's two sides to that coin. One is if you're investing in a place that's already well known and attracting tourists or attracting domestic tourists, whatever the case may be, then properties are not going to be cheap there, which as a result means that the yields will be compressed as well. And if you're investing in a real rural gem, diamond in the rough kind of location, which is what I think you're envisioning there, then you have to market not just your property, you have to market the entire area because nobody's going to come there unless you make it look like it's worth their while to take a holiday there, right? So you're kind of becoming the tourist promotion department for the entire town or prefecture or whatever it is, and that's hard work.
For sure, 100%. Yeah, that was very valuable. Thank you so much. So next question that I had was, what's a strong popular belief about Japanese real estate, or even property management, that you strongly disagree with?
Popular belief. I guess, well, it depends on who you're asking. If you're asking Japanese landlords, then their assumption is that foreigners are trouble. And as someone who's had and still has, and our clients have and still have both foreign and Japanese tenants, I can definitely testify to the fact that there are a lot of profiles of Japanese tenants that are equally troublesome or worse in some cases. I guess the assumption that foreigners make, on the other hand, when they come and invest in property here, is that it's similar to other countries, is you raise the rent every time the lease expires. That's not the case here. Cost of living has been going up. Salaries have not really been going up to any significant degree, which means that rents haven't been going up. So I can try to raise the rent, but the tenant's just going to move out and find a cheaper property if I do that. What else? Yeah, people assume that if they have an apartment or a house that's right next to a train line or a railway station, that's an issue. In our experience, Japanese tenants barely spend time at home. They come home, at least in the cities, they come home late at night after a long day of work, and they care a lot more about the convenience than any conception of noise that they might have. They just use the place to sleep, to crash, basically. People are assuming that somewhere in the suburbs or the countryside is similar to other countries, might be more attractive, whereas most people just want to stay as close as they can to the big cities. They're looking more for convenience of transportation than the extra floor space that you might find in the suburbs. That's a big thing for foreigners, not such a big thing for your typical Japanese tenants. I don't know, list goes on and on.
I was quite surprised by what you said as well. I heard in the previous podcast that you did, that you're not really, or you're not, you can't really increase rent every time you renew the lease, or else they just leave. And now, when you turn a place into a minpaku place, I think that's what it's called. People do have trouble with it, and they have to compensate quite a lot. But that older gentleman, usually fight for it, and go to court, etc., and try to
No,
win.
that doesn't happen here much at all. But
Oh.
the law is on their side. So to avoid the potential for somebody thinking about that or doing that, we would compensate them because the legislation here is very tenant oriented, meaning that if they would want to take you to court, then they would have a legal leg to stand on. But that has not happened to us ever. Having said that, we do offer compensation every time if we want to not renew the lease, but still, Japanese tenants are very conflict averse. It's very rare that they would take you to court. It's just that they have the legal right to if they choose to.
Yeah, I believe you said 6 to 10 months is like the typical amount that you'd give someone.
I mean, that's what it costs them to move, so that would be the nice thing, the fair thing to do.
For sure. Yeah, okay. For the next question, I understand that there's always different sides to it, such as investing, investment purposes, or second home purposes. But what's like a typical profile of foreign buyers of Japanese real estate to be?
That there's no such thing. Depends on what kind of real estate. If you're talking about investment real estate, holiday homes, if you're talking about minpaku short-term stay properties, you're talking about land for development, there's very, very different types of investors. We've got everyone from, younger people whose entire life savings is, I don't know, 30, 40, 50,000 bucks, and they want to buy a ski condo that they can use when they come here to ski in the winter. Or they want to buy an old dilapidated Akiya somewhere in the countryside and grow vegetables. And we have people buying multi-million dollar central Kyoto or Tokyo homes. They run the gamut. So there's no one profile for real estate. I can give you a profile for a particular type of property, but not for real estate.
Right. Thank you.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So, really, the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens, and they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which, if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So, if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now, back to the podcast.
So another question is, do you see different sorts of motivation from different people from different places, such as North America, Europe, Asia? I ask this because a lot of times those in North America, they do see Japanese real estate as more as investments because of the distance that they have to take to visit Japan, etc. Whereas people from Asia or Europe who might be closer to Japan see it more as a second home place.
No, I wouldn't say so. We've got both. It's maybe more of the age group and professional background thing than it is a country thing. In Asia, we do get maybe more family offices, which is not a huge thing in Western countries, but it is a thing in Asia and some parts of Europe. Whereas when we're talking Australia, Canada, USA, and other parts of Europe, it's mostly individuals or couples. But aside from that, it depends on their age and their professional leanings and what they're looking for. It also ebbs and flows with macroeconomic factors, right? Like when we started, which is back in 2011, that was right after global financial crisis, and everybody was looking for attractive deals, investment, because they know that, when the crisis hits, then opportunities abound. And everybody in the US, for example, were buying foreclosure properties in their backyard. Nobody wanted to go out of the country because they had so many good deals there. And then we got a lot of people from Australia and Singapore. As the US market recovered over the years and they stopped getting those good deals, and we started getting more and more US-based investors. These days, probably due to Ukraine and post-COVID dynamics, we have a lot more investors from Europe. So it ebbs and flows with whatever's happening in the world. Now, again, I'm getting a huge influx of people from the States looking to park their money elsewhere because of all kind of political stuff that happens in the States. So it comes and goes.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And very quick question about sort of having a vacation home in Japan or selling or renting it out. How important do you think this unique Japanese emotional experience is in renting out a vacation home? Because most of the time, people who visit Japan do it for a specific reason, you know? Nature is sort of similar to a lot of places on the East Coast of the US or Canada, but they go to Japan for that cultural and emotional experience. So, do you think it's important to sort of have this Japanese style vacation home or Japanese style bed, et cetera, over a Western style vacation home?
I see both, to be honest. We see a lot of people who come here for the Japanese traditional architecture home experience, but then they might furnish the place in very modern Western style, whatever's comfortable for them. And we do have a lot of people though who do go. It's really hard to set a profile, man. There's all kinds of people buying for all kinds of different reasons with different attitudes towards taste and interior design. We have a lot of people who just want a really convenient, comfortable condo unit in the city, and then they'll obviously furnish it more modernly. And we have people who are looking for that. There's everything.
Do you have a personal preference or?
Me? I'd probably go for a modern build, but with interior traditional design. So not real old stuff, but stuff that feels a bit more traditional. But as far as the property exterior goes, I've stayed in too many traditional Japanese houses that are freezing in the winter with very noisy creaking windows and sliding doors that often break, or so I'm not a huge fan. But my wife and partner, Chikako, on the other hand, is a huge fan of these, and she loves to restore these old homes and keep them as original as possible. So even within our own home, we run the gamut, I guess.
I see. Okay. That's good to hear about your personal experience. I remember in the presentation that you did for the summit, you said that inspection is not the norm. Is that right?
For Japanese buyers, yeah. We recommend it to all of our clients if they're buying anything that's 30 years and older. But for your typical Japanese buyer, it's not a give. It's a little bit more common than it used to be, but still very much the rarity rather than the norm.
See, yeah, I was quite surprised to hear about that, considering all kinds of issues that Japanese houses might have.
Well, the
Before.
main issue is that they're not built to last. So anybody who's buying them at this age, if they're Japanese, is kind of assuming that within 10, 20 years they'll tear it down and build a new one. So they're not really bothered with it.
Yeah. And so when buyers approach you talk to buyers, do you often see sort of this fear regarding earthquake, or rather the mega earthquake that is supposed to be coming soon? Like, do they feel hesitant, or do you see like a drop in interest for real estate?
No, earthquakes come and go here, and a lot of people talk about it. But once they understand that insurance covers most of those damages, they're a lot less concerned. It's obviously not a good thing if you're at the property when it happens. But from a financial perspective, insurance will cover most of it, especially if it's an older home.
In my experience from the people that I do talk to with this fear of quote-unquote mega earthquake brewing, they feel more and more hesitant about moving to Japan or even buying a property in Japan. I understand the
Are
insurance.
these people that considered it previously, you mean, and then
They
something
consider.
happened? Okay.
So yeah, but then they're starting to see YouTubes or news articles about this mega earthquake that's coming. I mean, after 2011, seeing what happened, it's quite traumatic for not just Japanese people, but for everyone thinking about going to Japan as well. I myself know a few friends who visited Japan who were constantly afraid of it. Do you think there's a way for, Asians in Japan to, how to say, not calm down necessarily, but explain that it is, relatively safe in Japan when it comes to mega earthquakes, despite what we saw in 2011?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's super safe. It can always happen. But I mean, if I look at every country that I've lived in or visited, there's always something bad that might happen at a relatively high frequency, right? In the US, you could get shot. In Australia, you could be caught in the bushfire. In, I mean, every country has its own thing. So, yeah, in Japan, it's earthquakes. But, the Japanese people, at least that I know, are very. The Shogunai mentality is like, hey, if it happens, it happens. We have our little earthquake kit, and everyone's well trained, starting from very early in kindergarten, elementary school. They know exactly what to do and what kind of space to head out for. And I don't know, it's something that you just get used to living with. And I mean, Israel is terrorist attacks, whatever.
When I do have friends who are worried about earthquakes, I do reassure them that I've lived through 2011. I came out fine. I lived in Chiba Prefecture, Funabashi, quite close to Fukushima and all that. But we have all as kids been trained how to deal with earthquake situation. I remember in my shogakko, elementary school, we'd have this soft pillow behind the chair that you put on top of your head when there is an earthquake. Buildings are built to last, built to endure earthquakes. Even during 2011, Tokyo, nothing fell really. All the buildings sway as it should. And when I show them
The
video,
concrete structures definitely are, yeah. And the houses are built in such a way that they're not going to cause a lot of damage to people passing in the street when they come breaking down. But the wooden houses are not built to last.
for sure.
They're built to cause less damage when they break down, I think.
I do. That's sort of how I reassure my friends that, like, look, this was a massive earthquake that happened at one point. And, a lot of things happened, but still a lot of people were saved by the amazing technology or, the way we built buildings over in Japan. So yeah, I just want to move on to the property management side now. Just the first question is that it seems that property management is crucial. When it comes to buying properties for foreigners in Japan, let's say reading documents, paying the bills, let's say, if you're on a tourist visa, etc. How crucial do you think it is to have property management company for a foreign buyer, depending on, let's say, their visa status or cash flow, etc.?
Well, if you're not living here, it's impossible to have a property without a property manager because you're going to get in trouble with the neighbors, the municipality. You're going to have, I mean, just the humidity and the mold are such a huge issue here. If you leave it closed and nobody opens the window at least every month or other month, then the mold is going to eat through your entire interior, right? If you have a garden or a backyard, you have to religiously maintain it to avoid getting in trouble with your neighbors and the local municipality. If you're up in snow country, then you need to take care of snow clearing on the roof. So if you're a remote owner or a remote landlord, and definitely if you have tenants, then you have to have a property management company. It's not an option not to.
And do you think people, let's say, who are not on tourist visa, who are able to open bank accounts, could theoretically get away with not having a property management if they do visit every few months or so?
Yeah, that's doable. I'd say every other month, especially in the summer, because that's when you really want to air the place out, and that's when the garden grows beyond control as well. So somewhere between late spring to the end of summer, I think you definitely want to make sure that you're here at least once a month. But if you can pull that off, then yeah, it's doable.
And When we approach foreign buyers of Japanese properties, especially for those who've never lived in Japan, I think it's really important that we set the expectation of what's to come post-purchase, right? What do you think are like some of the factors that foreign buyers still really underestimate, like heavily underestimate? Would you say it's like the maintenance part of it or?
I'd say definitely if it's a wooden house, it's the maintenance, and not just the maintenance in the sense of property management, but the actual maintenance of the structure, the repairs and the wear and tear that comes with these places over time. I think they underestimate how much a relationship with the neighbors can make or break your experience when you come to stay at your property. I think they underestimate the lack of infrastructure in smaller Japanese towns and villages, and the lack of English services in many places in Japan. They underestimate what an uninsulated property might feel like in the winter, especially. Yeah, bunch of stuff.
That's something that you personally experienced.
In clients' properties, not in the ones that I've lived in. I've taken care
Absolutely.
to insulate mine, but yeah.
Now, if you're actively looking at property in Japan, you should check out Akiya Mart. That's Akiya hyphen Mart, Mart, akiyamart.com. It's the Zillow of Japan, built for buyers who are actively hunting for a home in Japan and want a much more Western-style web browsing experience than the typical local Japanese websites. Now, we've got an exclusive 30% off promo code for the AkiyaMart Pro annual plan. That's the one that gives you full access to Airbnb zoning maps, hazard maps, sold data, and over 500,000 listings nationwide at any given time. So if you're serious about buying in Japan and you want an easier way to search, this is the best tool that we know of. So you can use my code ZIV, ZIV at checkout and get 30% off your AkiyaMart Pro annual plan at akiyamart.com.
I think that when it comes to buying properties for foreigners in Japan, they often see sort of the surface level of what it's like. Let's say IKEA videos, it's been very popular the past few years, and a lot of people start to dream about it. And when they see those, let's say, cheap prices, like really cheap, especially relative to the US or Canada, they want to just immediately go into it. So it seems to be really important that we set the expectation, we inform them and educate people on how to really navigate that process of buying a place and what to do with it after you do. And personally, from what I've seen, it seems like there's not a lot of videos on it. So I think it would be real nice to be able to see more of that on YouTube, etc. But yeah,
It's a
next.
large part of what we do, yes. I mean, when we get a new client, it often, I mean, sometimes we get lucky and they already know, but often it's a lot of pre-mature education before we actually go ahead and help them buy or manage anything. And some people just refuse to recognize the gravity of it, and then we have to let them go and say that we're not the best fit for them because we know how it's going to end and what's coming down the track after settlement. We just don't want to be involved.
Right, totally understandable. Yeah. Do you find some people, after they buy a property, they realize how much of a hard work it is and they decide to sell it? And if so, is it difficult to find, buyers after that point?
Depends what they bought.
Right, for sure. Yeah. Let's
If
say,
they bought an attractive property based on our recommendation, then usually it'll be easy and liquid and fairly easy to get rid of. But we have a client who, against our best advice and our better judgment, bought a, I think, 1960s or early 70s property surrounded by almost 1 square kilometer of forest land up a cliff. Nobody wants to buy it from him. He doesn't want to pay the landscape maintenance fees, which are, of course, huge. And now he's getting in trouble with the municipality and the neighbors. And he's blaming us, even though we told him from the get-go that, he's thinking we're just getting him bad quotes and he's being scammed, when we were trying to explain to him from the get-go that it's going to be very expensive to maintain a property like that. But people don't listen, and they don't listen. What can we do?
Yeah, I think it's definitely important to listen to an expert when you're buying a familiar area or even a country, as a whole. I mean, Japan, it's not the most easy country to get to know, considering there's a lot of language barrier, culture barrier, And you know what, even when you live in Japan personally as a foreigner, you still have a very di different experience from what local Japanese people might have. You know, that's something that is difficult to, I think, overcome even after decades of living. That was my personal experience. I mean, of course, I was a kid, but to me, I was
No,
Japanese.
same. And when I moved here, I made all of these same mistakes. That's part of the reason we got into this business, is to help people avoid those mistakes.
100%. And just a few last questions that I have. Do successful short-term rental owners think more like investors or hosts? If it's both,
They think like business owners.
like business owners, I see. Okay.
Yes.
What do
If
you
you
think?
want to run a hospitality property, you're running a business. It takes attention, it takes tweaking. It takes being creative. It takes working with experts who know what they're doing, and it's very hands-on.
You could be the best guest, but that doesn't mean that you'll be a successful business person. Is that what, sir, what are you trying to say?
That's one part of it. The other part of it is you need to be ready for the mental bandwidth that it's going to require. It's not set and forget. You have to constantly have your finger on the pulse and see what the competition is doing and maintain relationship with your suppliers and your neighbors and your guests. It's a full-on job.
I see. Okay. And final question would be, this is something that I know everyone's thinking about, and you know, I'm sure it's been covered in many different videos or areas on YouTube or anywhere online. But what do you personally think about the shrinking population? Because when a lot of people see this population issue that Japan is having, they feel, you know, a bit hesitant to invest in Japan, considering that there's going to be more and more houses that are emptying up, right? So what do you personally think about
So
that?
we touched on that in the beginning. I personally don't invest in Akiya. I might buy a house for personal use or for some creative business purpose, but as an investment from the sense of placing a tenant in there and collecting the rent, I wouldn't invest in rural Akiyas. But again, me personally, especially with the nature of Japanese real estate and how non-durable most of the houses are, the single family homes at least. I look 10 to 15 years to the future, not beyond that. And in the next 10 to 15 years, I see that the villages and townships again are going to be constantly conglomerating into the bigger metropolitan centers. And I see people moving closer and closer to the bigger stations and the bigger metro centers. And those are the places that I would be investing in for at least the next couple of decades. And beyond that is over my pay grade, man. Maybe we'll get a government who finally recognizes that immigration is a thing, or that, we should give women a bit more freedom to choose their lifestyle and a career so that they're feeling more comfortable to raise a family. But maybe that'll happen. Maybe it won't happen. Maybe we'll invest elsewhere. For the next 10, 20 years, I'll focus on city centers.
You know, what you said in the beginning about a lot of young. To me, the most charming places of Japan are the rural areas. You know, it's rich in nature, and there's a lot of local people that, you know, appreciate the tourists that do come around because they're rarely visited.
Do they?
In my
Some of them
personal
do. Some of them do. Some of them are extremely stubborn in their fear of foreigners, including local municipalities and some of the locals. And yeah, there are some. So I don't know. And now the government that they've currently got in place is catering to that fear, right? They keep stoking the fire and telling people all the scary foreigners are out here to get them. So I don't know, man. The pendulum swings. Maybe it'll swing back the Gaijin way one day or another. But so far, it's touch and go. Some municipalities are better than others in that regard, but definitely not all of them, in my opinion.
No, I totally understand what you mean. As someone who speaks Japanese and who grew up speaking Japanese, like people do, the people that I meet at least do appreciate that, you know, I respect culture and language, that, you know, I try my best to integrate rather than, you know, be like a nail that sticks out, which, you know, of course, you know, Japan does not like to.
If you get the option, sometimes our face is enough to make us stick out. So nobody's going to stick around long enough to figure out if we are trying to integrate or not, right? I don't. I mean, I respect the culture and the customs, and I try my best to be respectful. But there are some people who just see a foreigner and have all these preconceptions in mind already and their prejudices. So I'm not going to argue with them. I just find the ones that are not like that.
Sure. Yeah. And last question. This is a personal opinion for you. So it's not an objective question at all. But what is sort of like a dream house that you envision in Japan if you had, let's say, unlimited budget? I think you got to ask like, 1 billion yen budget question. But what's a dream house to you? Not just for investment, but also for your personal enjoyment.
Someplace with a really big garden, assuming that I have the money or the time to maintain it. My partner Chikako is a lot better at that than I am, but I definitely enjoy spending time in the garden. Yeah, like we mentioned, modern build with but with a very nice traditional interior. I love those indoor patio gazebos that are open with a tree in the middle, kind of open. So something like that, I guess.
So you really do appreciate this mix of sort of Japanese and Western style of
Yeah, the fusion style is my thing. Yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it, Ziv, and I hope that I'll be able to attend the summit next year. That'd be really wonderful.
My pleasure, man. Great speaking to you.
So there you have it. Nice interview, I thought, on a wide range of topics. I hope it brought as much value to Elia as it did to you. Let me know your thoughts, and if there are any other topics that you'd like me to cover in future episodes or conversations with other people, let us know. We aim to please. Now, we can't let you go without telling you all about Yen Loans, our latest sponsor. They're a new non-bank lender offering financing to non-residents of Japan for purchases of Tokyo condominiums, soon to be expanding to other major cities as well, so definitely hit them up if you're looking to purchase in Osaka, Fukuoka, Kyoto, or any other big city too. And that's for any purpose, whether it's a holiday home, investment rental, or a combination of both, without any requirement for residency, a Japanese bank account, a Japanese corporate structure, or representative director, any of these things, and with a streamlined application process too. So reach out to them through the link in our show notes and let them know that you found them on the Japan Real Estate Podcast. And if you're quick enough to be one of the first 10 completed applications, you'll receive a 25% discount. That's 50,000 yen off the 200,000 yen application fee. To qualify, apply through the link in our show notes again, or enter the code JREYL on their website, yenloans.com. And that's it from us for this episode, folks. Huge thank you for tuning in. Please do follow and subscribe to the show if this is your first time listening, and we'd love it if you could like and even share this episode with anyone you think might find interest in it. But even more importantly, we love hearing from you. So please let us know what you thought about this episode or the podcast overall in the comments section here on our social media channels. We've got a very active Facebook group and business page, both under the name Japan Real Estate on Facebook. And that's also the name and URL of our YouTube channel if you'd like to follow us there, Japan Real Estate on YouTube as well. And we'd of course appreciate your rating or review on Spotify or on the Apple Store or wherever you're tuning in from. Hope to have you with us again. Have a great rest of the day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.